and it became clear that he was listening to something Juliet couldn't hear. From light to shadow, in an instant. "Something funny, Tippy Toes," she said, coming to sit beside him. He nodded and picked up one of his feathers, twisting it back and forth between his fingertips. Juliet swept a piece of dried leaf from his knee. "Tell me. I love jokes."
"It wasn't a joke."
"No,
it was just Birdie."
Juliet had been expecting this. Nonetheless, her stomach tightened. He continued,
"She makes me laugh."
Juliet kept her side to herself and said, "Well now, that's good, Tippy. If you're going to spend time with people, it's important to choose people who can make you laugh."
"Does Daddy make you laugh, Mummy?"
"More than anyone. Except perhaps you three."
"Birdie says..."
He stopped short. "What is it, Tippy? What does she say?" He shook his head, focusing his attention on the stone he was turning over in his lap. Juliet tried another tack.
"Is Birdie with us now, Tip?"
A nod.
"Right here, sitting on the ground?"
Another nod.
"What does she look like?" "She has long hair."
"Does she?" He lifted his gaze slightly to look straight ahead of him.
"It's red. Her dress is long too."
Juliet followed his glance and sat up straighter, forcing a broad smile onto her face. "Hello there, Birdie," she said. "It's lovely to meet you at last. I'm Juliet, Tip's mummy, and I've been meaning to thank you. Tippy told me that you said he should help me, and I just wanted to let you know what a good boy he's been. Helping me with washing up at night, folding clothes with me when the other two are behaving like wild things. I really couldn't be prouder." Tip's little hand crept into hers, and Juliet gave it a squeeze.
"Being a parent's a breeze," came Alan's cheerful voice on the wind. "No more difficult than flying a plane with a blindfold on and holes in your wings."
Chapter 21. At 6 o'clock on Friday evening, the four of them set off together down the lane towards the village. For children wearing the hand-me-downs of strangers, they had scrubbed up pretty well. And by 6:30, having stopped to admire a number of long-lashed cows in a field along the way, and to allow Tip to collect a couple of stones that had caught his attention, they crossed the triangular green to arrive at the Swan. Mrs. Hammett had said to come in through the main entrance, but to turn right instead of left into the dining room rather than the pub. She was already there, drinking cocktails with a tall woman of around 50 years old, who was wearing the most wonderful tortoise-shell-framed glasses that Juliet had ever seen. They both turned when Juliet and the children burst through the door, and Mrs. Hammett said,
"Welcome all, come on in. I'm so glad you made it."
"Sorry we're late." Juliet nodded fondly in Tip's direction. "There were important stones to be gathered along the way." The woman with the glasses said, "A boy after my own heart," her accent betraying a hint of America. The children stood relatively still to deliver the introductions Juliet had schooled them in along the walk, and then she ushered them back out to the entrance hall, where a pair of leather armchairs seemed to offer the perfect repository while they waited for dinner to be served. "Mrs. Wright," said Mrs. Hammett when Juliet returned, "this is Dr. Lovegrove. Dr. Lovegrove is staying with us in the accommodations upstairs. Another return visitor to the village. 1940 must be the year for it." Dr. Lovegrove held out a hand. "A pleasure to meet you," she said. "And please, call me Ada."
"Thank you, Ada. And I'm Juliet."
"Mrs. Hammett has just been telling me that you and your children have moved into Birchwood Manor." "We arrived on Sunday evening. I went to school in that house many years ago. I had heard it was a school once upon a time." "Once upon a time indeed. It closed decades ago, soon after I left. It was one of the last bastions of the old ideas about girls and their education. Plenty of sewing, singing, and as I remember it, quite a lot of balancing books on our heads when we should have been reading them.
Now, said Mrs. Hammett. Lucy did her best, and it doesn't seem to have done you any harm, Doctor. Ada laughed. That's true, and you're right about Lucy. I had so hoped to see her again. Such a shame. I only have myself to blame. I left it too long. Age catches up with us all, even Lucy, it would seem. In a funny way, I have the school at Birchwood for all its oddities to thank for the direction of my adult life. I'm an archaeologist, she explained to Juliet, a professor at New York University. But before all that, I was a very keen member of the Natural History Society at Miss Radcliffe's school. Lucy, a Miss Radcliffe, was a real enthusiast. I've met professors with less keen instinct. She'd amassed a wonderful collection of fossils and finds. Her specimen room was a veritable trove. It was only small, but then, of course, you'll know which one I mean. At the top of the stairs on the first floor. That's my room now, Juliet said with a smile. Then you can picture how crowded it was with shelves lining the walls and objects covering every available surface. I can, said Juliet, retrieving her notebook, which was never far from hand. And I love the notion that a single house has had so many different incarnations. In fact, it's given me an idea. She jotted down a note, explaining as she did so about letters from the laneway, to which description Mrs. Hammett couldn't resist adding. My ladies and I are already featured, Dr. Lovegrove. The debut article, no less. You will make sure we have copies, won't you, Mrs. Wright? I've instructed my editor especially, Mrs. Hammett. They'll be in the post on Monday morning. Wonderful. The ladies are so excited. Now, if you write about Lucy, you'll have to remember to mention that she was the sister of Edward Radcliffe. Juliet frowned lightly. The name was vaguely familiar. The artist, one of those Magenta Brotherhood they talk about. He died young, so he isn't as famous as the others. But it was he who bought the house there on the river. Something of a scandal there was. He and his friends were staying at the house one summer, a long time ago, back when my mother was just a girl. But she remembered it to her dying day. A beautiful young heiress was killed. She and Radcliffe were supposed to be married, but after she died, his heart was broken, and he never returned. It came to Lucy in his will. The door opened and Mr. Hammett arrived, fresh from his duties behind the bar, shepherding in a young kitchen maid with an anxious expression on her face and a tray of steaming plates in her hands. Ah, said Mrs. Hammett, beaming. Dinner is served. Just you wait to see what our cook can do with a steamed sausage roll. What their cook could do, it turned out, was nothing short of a miracle. Steamed end cuts had never been among Juliet's favourites, but served beneath a gravy of... better not to ask, the roll proved delicious. Equally pleasing, the children brought their most charming selves to the table, replying to every question with answers that were engaging, if perhaps a little frank for some tastes, even returning a few interesting queries of their own. Tip had managed to stick his little fingers in the waxy pools of each candle, leaving a smattering of small fossilized prints. But they remembered to say thank you when they were finished. No one blew his or her nose on the tablecloth, and when B asked whether they might please be excused to continue their game of cards in the entrance hall, Juliet was glad to say yes. "Are your children enjoying Birchwood Manor?" Ada asked, as Mrs. Hammett's kitchen maid worried over the pouring of tea and coffee. "It must be quite a change after London." "Thankfully, the change seems to agree with them." "But of course... the country offers so much for children," said Mrs. Hammett. "It would be a strange child indeed who didn't delight in our part of the world." Ada laughed. "I was always a strange child." "You didn't enjoy it here?" "Eventually, not at first. I was born in India and very happy there until I was packed off to school. I was not disposed to like it, and I didn't. I found the countryside insipid and polite. Unfamiliar, to put it in the best light." "How long did you spend at the school?" Just over 2 years. It closed when I was 10, and I was sent on to a bigger school, outside Oxford.
There was a terrible accident, said Mrs. Hammett. A girl drowned during a summer picnic. The school only lasted a few years after that.
She frowned at Ada.
Then Dr. Lovegrove, you must have been there when it happened.
I was, said Ada, taking her glasses off to clean a lens.
Did you know the girl?
Not well. She was older than I was. The other two women continued to talk, but Juliet had fallen to thinking of Tip. He had told her that a girl drowned in the river, and now she wondered whether he'd heard something in the village to that effect. But he had mentioned the fact to her on their first morning at Birchwood, so there hadn't been time for any of that. It was possible, she supposed, that the nervy young man from the AHA had whispered to him about it. Now that she thought about it, there'd been something a bit sly-looking about him. But then Tip might merely have been voicing his own deepest fears. Wasn't she always warning him, especially him, to be careful? Alan would say he'd told her so. She was turning them into scaredy-cats with her maternal worry. And perhaps Tip had simply made a good guess. People drowned in rivers. It was a safe bet that over time someone had drowned at just about any point along the Thames. She was only finding things to worry about, because she always worried about Tip. Mrs. Wright? Juliet blinked. I'm sorry, Mrs. Hammett. I was a million miles away. Everything's all right, I hope. Would you like some more coffee? Juliet slid her cup across the table with a smile, and as so often happened when one had been struggling with a prevailing worry alone, found herself explaining to the other women about Tip and his imaginary friend. The poor little mite, said Mrs. Hammett. Not surprising after all the changes. He'll come good, you'll see. One of these days you'll realise that he hasn't mentioned his friend. In a week. Perhaps you're right, said Juliet. I never had one myself, you see, and it just seems such a remarkable thing to conjure an entire person from thin air. Does his imaginary friend make him do naughty things? No, thank goodness, Mrs. Hammett. I'm pleased to say that she's been rather a good influence. Small mercies, said their host with a clap. Is she with us tonight? I've never had an imaginary guest. Happily, no. She stayed in for the night. Well, that's something. Perhaps it's a good sign that he only needs her sometimes. Perhaps, although he did say that he'd asked her to come. Apparently, she told him she couldn't walk that far. An invalid? How intriguing. Has he told you any other details about the child? She's not a child to begin with. She's a lady. I don't know what that says about me, that he's chosen to create an adult woman to spend time with. Perhaps she's another version of you, said Mrs. Hammett. No, not so. From what he tells me, she's almost my direct opposite. Long red hair, a long white dress. He's been quite specific in his description. Ada, who had been quiet to this point, said, Have you considered that he's being truthful? There was a momentary silence, and then... Why, Dr. Lovegrove, said Mrs. Hammett with a nervous laugh. You are a tease. But Mrs. Wright is worried. Oh, I shouldn't worry, said Ada. I'm sure it means nothing more than that your little boy is a creative spirit who has invented his own way to cope with the changes in his life.
You sound like my husband, said Juliet with a smile. And no doubt you're right.
As Mrs. Hammett began to talk about seeing what had happened to the pudding, Ada excused herself to take some fresh air, and Juliet took the opportunity to check on the children. Red and Bee were easy enough to find, ensconced as they were within the pleasantly dim space beneath the stairs, engaged in a boisterous round of gin rummy. Juliet scanned the hallway for Tip.
Where's your brother?
Neither looked up from their fan of cards.
Don't know. Somewhere.
Juliet stood for a moment with her hand on the post at the bottom of the stairs, surveying the hall. As her gaze swept up the carpeted flight, for a split second she saw Alan standing at the top, that infernal pipe in his mouth. It was the same staircase she'd raced up that day, to find him waiting for her inside the room, armed and ready to resume their argument. She couldn't resist climbing it now. The banister felt familiar beneath her hand, and Juliet closed her eyes as she neared the top, imagining herself back to that instant in time. An echo of the memory charged the air around her. Alan was so close she could smell him. But when she opened her eyes, he, with his smile of lopsided irony, was gone. The first floor landing was exactly as she remembered. Clean and neat, with little details that showed care if not au courant artistry. Fresh flowers in the porcelain vase on the hall table, small framed paintings of local landmarks along the wall, imprints from the carpet sweeper on the mottled runner. There was the same smell, too, of laundry soap and wood polish, and underlying it, the faint comforting hint of day-old ale. No sign, though, of a small fleet-footed boy. As she came back down, Juliet heard a familiar voice drifting in from outside the pub. She had noticed a bench seat beneath the window when they arrived, and went closer now, leaning to peer through the crack in the blackout curtains and over the edge of the sill. There he was, some of his prized sticks and stones in hand, and beside him, Ada, the two of them deep in conversation. Juliet smiled to herself and stepped back quietly, careful not to disturb them. Whatever it was they were discussing, Tip's face was interested and engaged. "There you are, Mrs. Wright." It was Mrs. Hammett bustling behind the kitchen maid, who was struggling beneath another heavily laden tray. "Ready for some pudding? I'm pleased to say it's eggless sponge with strawberry jelly." On Sunday morning, for the first time since they'd arrived, Juliet woke before the children. Her legs were as restless as her mind, so she threw on some clothing and headed out for a walk. She didn't go to the river, following the lane back into the village instead. As she neared the corner with the church, she noticed that people were filing in for the early service. Mrs. Hammett saw her and waved, and Juliet smiled back. The children were at home, so she didn't go inside, but listened for a time from the bench beneath the porch as the minister spoke about loss and love and the indomitable human spirit when it walked hand in hand with God. It was a thoughtful sermon, and he a fine speaker. But Juliet feared there would be many more sermons like that before the war was over. Her gaze roamed the pretty churchyard. It was a peaceful place, lots of spilling ivy and slumbering souls. Headstones that told of age and youth and death's blind justice. A forlorn, beautiful angel bowed her head over an open book, her stone hair darkened with age, tumbling onto the cold page. There was a quality to the silence in such places that inspired reverence. To strains of Elgar's Nimrod, Juliet wandered the perimeter, observing the mottled headstones and contemplating the names and dates, the loving messages of eternity and rest. How remarkable that the human race valued the lives of its individual members sufficiently to commemorate each one's brief time on the ancient earth, and yet at once could engage in slaughter of the most meaningless and general kind. At the bottom of the churchyard, Juliet stopped in front of a grave bearing a familiar name, Lucy Eliza Radcliffe, 1849 to 1939. Beside it was an older headstone belonging to the brother Mrs. Hammett had mentioned at dinner, Edward. Written beneath Lucy's name were the words, "All past is present," a phrase that gave Juliet pause, for it was somehow out of step with the usual sentiments expressed. Past, present, future. What did any of it mean anyway? One could aim to do their best with the circumstances dealt them in the time given. That was all. Juliet left the churchyard, walking back along the grass-lined laneway towards home. The rising sun had burned off any hint of overnight cool, and the sky was clarifying to a spectacular blue. There would be more requests for boating today, that much was clear. Perhaps they would all have lunch by the river. The house had the look of wakeful inhabitants, even from a distance. Strange the way one could somehow tell. Sure enough, even before Juliet had reached the coachway, she was met with the sound of Bee's recorder. Mrs. Hammett had sent them home with four lovely hen's eggs, and Juliet was looking forward to soft boiling them. She even planned to use real butter on the soldiers. First, though, she ducked upstairs to put her hat back in her room. She looked in on the children on the way and found Bee sitting cross-legged on her bed like a snake charmer, playing her recorder. Freddy was lying across his mattress on his back, his head touching the ground. He appeared to be holding his breath. There was no sign of Tip. "Where's your brother?" she said. Beatrice lifted her shoulders without missing a note. Red on a hot exhalation. "Upstairs!" There was an unmistakable air of altercation in the room, and Juliet knew better than to get involved. Fights between siblings, she had learned, were like smoke in the wind, blinding one moment, gone the next. "Breakfast in 10 minutes," was her retreating statement. She tossed her hat onto her bed and ducked her head around the corner of the old sitting room at the end of the hall. They hadn't been using the room as a matter of course. It was filled with sheet-draped furniture and rather dusty, but such places were a lure for children. Tip wasn't there either, but Red had thought he might be in the attic. She jogged up the stairs, calling his name as she went. "Breakfast, Tip, love. Come and help me make the soldiers." Nothing. "Tip?" She searched each corner of the various attic rooms and then stood at the window that overlooked the field towards the river. The river. Tip was not a wanderer. He was timid by nature. He wouldn't have gone that far without her. She was not calmed. He was a child. He was distractible. Children drowned in rivers. "Tip!" Juliet's voice was unmistakably worried now, and she started quickly down the stairs. She almost missed the muffled, "Mummy?" as she hurried along the hall. Juliet stopped and listened. It was not easy to hear over her own panic. "Tip?"
"I'm here."
It was as if the wall were speaking, as if it had eaten Tip and he were now trapped within its skin. And then, before her eyes, a crack appeared in the surface and a panel was revealed. It was a hidden door, and behind it Tip was smiling at her. Juliet grabbed him and pressed him hard against her chest. She knew she must be hurting him, but she couldn't help herself.
"Tippy! Oh, Tippy, my love!" "I was hiding."
"I see that."
"Ada told me how to find the hidey hole."
"Did she?" He nodded.
"It's a secret."
"And a jolly good one. Thank you for sharing it with me." Remarkable how calm she could make her voice sound when her heart was still pummeling her ribs. Juliet was faint. "Sit with me a minute, Tippy Toes." She lifted him down and the sliding door shut seamlessly behind him.
"Ada liked my stones. She said that she used to collect stones too, and fossils. Now she's an
ologist. An archaeologist."
"Yes,"
he agreed.
"One of those."
Juliet took Tip with her to the top step and sat him on her lap. She had her arms around him and her cheek resting on the top of his warm head. Of all her children, Tip was the most willing to accept these occasional bouts of excessive parental love. Only when she felt that she was straining even his unending patience did she say, "Right, breakfast, and time, I think, to find out what your brother and sister are fighting about."
"Bee said that Daddy wouldn't be able to find us here when he comes home."
"Did she?"
"And Red said that Daddy was a magician and that he could find us no matter where we were."
"I see."
"And I came upstairs because I didn't want to tell them."
"Tell them what?"
"That Daddy isn't coming home."
Juliet felt lightheaded. "What do you mean?" He didn't answer, but instead reached his little hand up to press lightly on her cheek. His small heart-shaped face was solemn, and Juliet could see at once that he knew. She was aware of the letter in her pocket, the last that she'd received from Alan. She had carried it with her everywhere since it had arrived. That was the only reason she still had it. The black-rimmed telegram from the War Office that had arrived the same day was gone now. Juliet had planned to burn it herself, but in the end she hadn't needed to. One of Hitler's men had taken care of things for her, dropping his bomb when he was directly above Queen's Head Street, Islington, destroying their house and everything in it. She had meant to tell the children. Of course she had. The problem was, and Juliet had thought of little else, there was simply no acceptable way to tell her children that their wonderful, funny, forgetful, silly father had been killed.
Mummy?
Tip slipped his hand into Juliet's.
What will happen now?
There was a lot that Juliet would have liked to say. It was one of those occasions that came rarely, in which a parent recognised that what she said next would remain with her child forever. She so wanted to be equal to it. She was a writer, and yet the right words would not come. Every explanation that she considered and discarded put another beat of silence between the perfect moment for response and the moment that she was now in. Life really was a great big pot of glue, just like Alan had always said, a jar of flour and water in which they were all just trying to tread water as elegantly as they could.
I'm not entirely sure, Tippy, she said,
which was neither reassuring nor wise, but truthful, which was at least something. But I do know that we're going to be all right. She knew what he would ask next. He would ask her how she knew, and what on earth could she say to that? Because she just did? Because they had to be? Because this was her plane and she was flying it? And blindfolded or not, she was damn well going to make sure that they got home safely. In the end, she was spared having to answer because she was wrong. He didn't ask her that at all. With a faith that made Juliet want to curl up and weep, he took her at her word and moved on to a different subject entirely.
Birdie says that even inside the darkest box, there are pinpricks of light.
Juliet was suddenly bone-weary.
Does she, darling?
Tip nodded earnestly.
And it's true, Mummy. I saw them inside the hidey hole. You can only see them from inside. I was frightened at first when I closed the panel, but I didn't need to be, because there were hundreds of little lights in there, twinkling in the dark.
8. It is Saturday and the tourists have arrived. I am in the small room where Fanny's portrait hangs upon the wall, or as I prefer to think of it, Juliet's bedroom. Fanny, after all, slept here only one night. I used to sit with Juliet while she was working at her typewriter. Her papers spread out across the dressing table beneath the window. I was with her too, late in the evening, after the children were asleep, when she would take out Alan's letter. Not to read, she didn't often do that. She just used to hold it in her hand as she sat and looked, unseeing, through the open window into the long dark night. This is also the room where Ada was brought, after being pulled half-drowned from the river. Back then it was a trove of fossils and specimens next door to Lucy's bedroom, the walls lined with shelves from floor to ceiling. Lucy insisted on taking over Ada's care herself, instructing the nurse on how to do her job, until the nurse eventually refused to do it any longer. There was not a lot of space to move after the bed was carried back in, but Lucy managed to fit a wooden chair in one corner and would sit there in the evenings for hours at a time, watching the sleeping child. It was touching to see how caring Lucy was. Little Lucy, who had found so few people in her life, after Edward, to be close to. She made certain that the bed was warmed each night with a brass pan filled with coals, and she allowed Ada to keep the kitten, despite that Thornfield woman's evident disapproval. One of today's tourists has gone to stand by the window, craning to see over the wall and into the orchard so that the morning sun bleaches her face. It reminds me of the day after the picnic, when Ada was well enough to be propped up against her pillows, and light spilled through the panes of glass in four neat rectangles to fall across the foot of her bed. Lucy brought in the breakfast tray, and as she was setting it down on the dressing table, Ada, pale against the linen sheet, said, "I fell into the river."
"You did."
"I cannot swim."
"No, that much is clear." Ada did not speak again for a time. I could see, though, that there was more on her mind, and sure enough,
"Miss Radcliffe," she said eventually.
"Yes, child."
"Someone else was in the water with me."
"Yes."
Lucy sat at the edge of the bed and took up Ada's hand.
"I am sorry to have to tell you, but May Hawkins fell into the river too. She did not fare as well as you. She could not swim either, and she drowned."
Ada listened to this, and then her voice almost a whisper.
"It was not May Hawkins who I saw."
I waited then, wondering how much more she would tell Lucy, whether she would trust her with the truth of what had happened on the riverbed. But she spoke no more about the other person, saying instead,
"There was a blue light, and I reached out to grab it. And it wasn't a light at all. It was a stone, a shining stone."
She opened her hand and then revealed within her palm the Radcliffe blue, snatched from where it had been waiting amidst the river stones.
"I saw it shining and held on to it because I knew that it would save me. And it did. My very own amulet found me, right when I needed it. And it protected me from harm, just like you said it would."
The weather is fine and clear today, and so it is busy at the house. A constant stream of tourists with bookings for lunch at one of the nearby pubs. They shuffle through in small groups, and I cannot bear to hear the guide tell yet another cluster to close their eyes in Fanny's bedroom and smell the ghostly hint of Miss Brown's favourite rose cologne. And so I have left and am making my way down to the malt house where Jack is trying to keep a low profile. Earlier this morning I saw amongst the papers he had printed from Mrs. Wheeler's recent email a letter from Lucy to Ada, written in March 1939. Alas, the body of the letter was covered, and I have not yet been able to see what it says. I am hopeful that by now he might have moved the other papers aside so I can have a proper read. In the hall downstairs, a group has gathered around the landscape painting that hangs upon the southern wall. It is the first work that Edward ever had accepted by the Royal Academy, one of the paintings referred to collectively as the Upper Thames Works, a view taken directly from the top window of this house. The vista itself is a pretty one, overlooking the river, a stretch of fields, a dense area of woodlands, and beyond that, the distant mountains. In Edward's hands, though, the pastoral scene is transmuted via shades of magenta and deepest grey into an image of disconcerting beauty. The painting was heralded as signifying a shift from representational paintings to art of atmosphere. It is a bewitching piece, and the tourists today say all of the same things that they always do. Things like, "Wonderful colours," and "Moody, isn't it?" And "Look at that technique." But few of them ever purchase poster copies from the shop. One of Edward's gifts was an ability to take his own emotions and, through choice of pigment and brushstroke, render them visually, with uncompromising fluency by the force of his own need to communicate and be understood. People do not purchase copies of View from the Attic Window to hang above their sofa because it is a painting fueled by fear, and despite its beauty, without even knowing the story behind its creation, they sense its menace. The landscape depicted in the painting impressed itself upon Edward when he was 14 years old. 14 is a fragile age, a time of changing perceptions and emotional transition, and Edward was a boy of particularly intense feelings. His was always a compulsive nature. I never knew him to be half-hearted about anything, and in his childhood, he had enjoyed a series of obsessive interests and pursuits, each the one until the next arrived. He was consumed with stories of fairyland and theories of the occult sciences, and had for some time been determined to raise a ghost. The idea had come to him from his illicit reading at school, hours spent poring by candlelight over ancient treatises found deep in the vaults of the library. It was at this time that Edward's parents embarked upon an art-collecting jaunt to the Far East, which took them away from England for the next year. Thus, when the summer holidays arrived, he was sent not to the house in London where he had grown up, but to his grandfather's estate instead. Wiltshire is an old and enchanted county, and Edward used to say that when the full moon rose high and silver, the ancient magic could still be felt. Although he resented his parents' abandonment of him and the despotic grandfather who must be born, his fascination with spirits and fairy lore was further fed by his removal to the chalk country. He thought carefully about where to go to raise his spirit and considered several nearby churchyards before a conversation with his grandfather's gardener convinced him instead to follow the River Cole until it met the Thames. There was a spot, the old man said, a clearing in a woods not far from there, where the river turned sharply back upon itself, in which fairies and ghosts still walked amongst the living. The gardener's grandmother had been born in the north during the chime hour and knew such things, and it was she who had told him of the secret place. Edward confided the events of that evening on a drizzly London night when we were together in his candle-lit studio. I have remembered the occasion of the telling so many times since that I can hear his voice now, as if he were standing right beside me. I can recount the story of that night in the woods as if I had been there with him when it happened. After walking for some hours, he found the river bend and ventured into the woods, leaving chalk flints that he had collected earlier that day as markers to guide him home. He arrived in the clearing just as the moon was rising to the centre of the sky. The night was clear and warm, and he had worn only the lightest of clothing, but as he crouched behind a fallen log, he felt a brush of something very cold against his skin. He shook the sensation away, thinking little of it then, for there were far more interesting things happening to occupy his thoughts. A beam of moonlight illuminated the clearing, and Edward felt the pull of premonition. Something he knew was about to happen. A strange wind blew, and the surrounding trees rattled their leaves like fine pieces of silver. Edward had a sense that there were eyes hidden in the foliage, watching the empty clearing, just as he was. Waiting. Waiting. And then suddenly, it was dark. He glanced skyward, wondering if a cloud had come from nowhere to blot out the moon, and as he did so, he was gripped by a sickening claw of terror. His blood was as ice, and without knowing why, he turned and fled back through the woods, picking his way from one piece of chalk to the next, until he emerged on the edge of the field. He continued, he thought, in the general direction of his grandparents' house. There was something behind him, chasing him. He could hear it over his own ragged breaths. But when he threw a glance over his shoulder, there was nothing there. His every nerve was alight, his skin rippled cold, as if it sought to leave his body. He ran, and he ran, the landscape dark and unfamiliar around him as he leapt over fences, broke through brambly hedgerows, and pounded across fields. All the while, the creature followed, and just when Edward thought that he could run no further, he glimpsed a house on the horizon, a light visible from a window at its top, like a lighthouse in a storm, signalling the way to safety. Heart thumping in his chest, he headed towards it, scaling the stone wall and leaping to the ground to land in a moon-silvered garden. A path of flagstones led to the front door. It was not locked and he opened it, hurrying inside and pushing the door closed behind him. He slid the bolt across. Edward climbed the stairs on instinct, moving higher and higher away from whatever it was that had pursued him through the fields. He did not stop until he reached the very top, the attic, and there was nowhere else to go. He went straight to the window, scanning the nocturnal landscape. And there he stayed, watchful and alert, taking in every detail of the view until at last dawn broke incrementally, miraculously, and the world was once again restored to normal. Edward confessed to me that for all the tales of mystery and horror that he had read and heard and invented for his sisters, the night in the clearing of the woods, when he fled for his life and sought refuge in this house, was his first experience of true fear. It changed him, he said. Terror opened up something inside him that could never be properly sealed. I know now exactly what he meant. True fear is indelible. The sensation does not recede, even when the cause is long forgotten. It is a new way of seeing the world, the opening of a door that can never be closed again. So when I look at Edward's view from the attic window, I do not associate it with the fields outside Birchwood Manor, even though the likeness is uncanny. It makes me think instead of small dark spaces and stale air, and the way a person's throat craves and burns when struggling to find the very air for their next breath. The tourists may not purchase posters of View from the Attic Window for their walls, but they do buy copies of La Belle. I suppose I should be flattered to think that my face stares out from above so many sofas. It is petty of me to care, but La Belle outsells any of the other posters available in the gift shop, including the works of Thurston Holmes. I have come to understand that people relish the hint of infamy that comes from hanging a jewel thief and possible murderess upon their pretty wall. Some of them, having read Leonard's book, compare La Belle to the portrait of Miss Frances Brown on the occasion of her 18th birthday, and say things like, "Of course, you can see that he was really in love with his model." It is a strange thing to hang upon the walls of so many people whom I do not know, over 150 years after I met Edward Radcliffe and sat for him in that tiny studio at the bottom of his mother's garden. To have one's portrait painted is among the most intimate of experiences. To feel the weight of another person's full attention and meet it eye to eye. I found it overwhelming enough when Edward finished and it came time for the painting to leave the studio and take its place on the Academy's wall. And that was well before it was possible for infinite copies to be made and sold and framed. For my face, as interpreted by Edward in 1861, to appear on shopping bags and tea towels and key rings and mugs and the cover of financial year diaries in the 21st century. I wonder what Felix, with his lapel button of Abraham Lincoln and his wild predictions for the future, would make of all this. It is just as he said. The camera is ubiquitous. They all carry one now. Even as I watch, they traipse through the rooms of the house, pointing their devices at this chair or those tiles. Experiencing the world at one remove, through the windows of their phones, making images for later so that they do not need to bother seeing or feeling things now. It was different after Edward came for me at Mrs. Mack's house on Little White Lion Street. Without discussing it, we each assumed a new permanence to our relationship that had been absent before. Edward began another painting, entitled Sleeping Beauty. But where once he had been the painter and I his model, now we were something else. Work bled into life, and life into work. We became inseparable. The first weeks of 1862 were bitterly cold, but the furnace in his studio kept us warm. I remember looking up at the glass roof misting over, the grey sky glowering, as I lay upon the bed of velvet cushions he'd assembled. My hair he spread around me, long strands over my shoulders, across my décolletage. We spent all day together, and much of the night, and when finally he put his brushes away, he would take me back to the Seven Dials, only to collect me again at daybreak. There was no longer any barrier to our conversation, and like a needle in the most adept of hands, it wove together the various threads of our lives, so that he and I became tied by the stories we shared with one another. I told him the truth about my mother and father, the workshop with its wonders, the trips to Greenwich, the tin in which I'd tried to capture light. I spoke to him of Pale Joe and our unlikely friendship, Mrs. Mack and the captain, little girl lost and my pair of white kid gloves. I trusted him with my real name. Edward's friends noticed his absence. He had always been subject to periods of obsessive work and retreat, leaving London for weeks at a time on creative travels that his family knew affectionately as his faraways. But evidently, his complete withdrawal in early 1862 was different. He did not pause in his endeavours even to write and send a letter, neither did he attend any of the weekly meetings of the Magenta Brotherhood in the public bar at the Queen's Larder. It was March, and Sleeping Beauty was all but finished by the time he introduced me to the others. We met at the home of Felix and Adele Bernard on Tottenham Court Road, a house with a plain brick facade that concealed rooms of great bohemian déshabillé. The walls were painted in burgundy and deepest blue, cluttered with enormous framed oil paintings and photographic prints. What seemed like hundreds of tiny flames flickered atop elaborate candelabras, casting shadows across the walls, and the air was thick with smoke and impassioned conversation.
"So you're the one,"
said Thurston Holmes, his eyes not leaving mine, when Edward introduced us again, and he lifted my hand to his lips, just as he had done at the Royal Academy. Once again I felt the same churn of warning deep down in the pit of my stomach. I was not then frightened of many things. Growing up in the Seven Dials had cured me of most fears, but Thurston Holmes unnerved me. He was a man used to getting his own way, a man who wanted for nothing material, but obsessed over that which he could not have. He possessed streaks of cruelty, both casual and calculated, and was expert at their deployment. I saw him slight Adele Bernard one night with a caustic comment about one of her early photographic efforts, and then sit back, a smile on the edge of his lips, enjoying the scene as sport. Thurston was interested in me, insofar as I presented a challenge, a treasure he could take away from Edward. I knew this at the time, but I confess I did not understand then to what lengths he would go, how willing he would prove to inflict unhappiness on others for his own amusement. I reflect sometimes on how much of what happened the summer of 1862 might have been averted had I gone with Thurston that evening in November after the exhibition at the Royal Academy, or paid him a well-placed compliment. But we all make choices, for better and for worse, and I had made mine. I continued to refuse his requests to paint me. I made sure that we were never alone together. I avoided his lingering attentions. For the most part, he was discreet, preferring to needle me in secret. Only once did he push things too far with Edward. What he said I do not know, but he paid for it with a purple eye that lasted into the next week. Mrs. Mack, meanwhile, was kept happy by frequent payments for my services as a model, and Martin was left with little choice but to grudgingly accept the turn events had taken. He continued to voice his disapproval whenever he saw an opportunity, and there were times when we would leave Edward's studio at night and a hint of movement in my peripheral vision would alert me to his presence on the other side of the street. But I could live with Martin's misguided attentions so long as he kept them at a distance. Edward's mother, for her part, encouraged our ongoing association. Sleeping Beauty was exhibited to wide acclaim in April 1862, and a hover of prospective patrons descended. She entertained dreams of Royal Academy glory and wild commercial success. But she was worried too, for while Edward's usual habit was to move on immediately to a new subject, he had not yet begun another painting. After the exhibition, he alternated instead between bouts of distraction, in which a faraway expression cast a glaze across his features, and periods of feverish scribbling in his notebook. Motivated by the quality of his recent work and her own reliance on his future, she urged him down to the studio day and night, plying me with cake and tea as if she feared that only by such morsels could I be kept from vanishing back to the place from which I had come. As for Fanny, aside from a brief nod of aloof acknowledgement at the exhibition of Sleeping Beauty, I saw her only once, when she and her mother came to tea with Mrs. Radcliffe and were walked down the garden path to observe the artist at work. They stood inside the door behind Edward's shoulder, Fanny preening and posing in a new satin dress.
"Goodness," she said. "Aren't the colours pretty?"
At which Edward met my eyes, and within his own I saw a smile of such warmth and longing that it took my breath away. Will you believe me if I say that in all of those months, Edward and I did not ever discuss Fanny? Neither did we consciously avoid the subject. It seems hopelessly naive to say it now, but Fanny simply was not on our minds. There was so much else to talk about, and she did not seem important. Lovers are ever selfish. It is one of my greatest regrets, to which I return over and again in my ruminations, wondering how I could have been so foolish, my failure to understand how unwilling Fanny would be to let Edward go. I was blinded, as was he, by the knowledge that for us there was no choice. We had to be together. Neither of us could contemplate the possibility that others could not see and would not accept this basic truth. She has come back. Elodie Winslow, the archivist from London, keeper of James Stratton's memory and Edward's sketchbook. I see her at the entrance kiosk, trying to buy a ticket to enter the house and garden. There is some sort of bother. I can tell by the air of polite frustration on her face as she gestures towards her watch. One glance at my clock in the Mulberry Room, and I know what the matter is. Sure enough, when I arrive at her side, it is in time to hear her say, "I would have arrived earlier, but I had another appointment. I came here immediately afterwards, but my taxi was stuck behind a piece of farm machinery and the lanes are so narrow he couldn't get past." "Be that as it may," says the volunteer whose badge announces that he is called Roger Westbury, "we only allow a fixed number of visitors in, and the last allotment for today is full. You'll have to come again next weekend." "But I won't be here. I have to go back to London." "I'm sorry to hear that, but I'm sure you understand. We have to protect the house. We can't have too many people traipsing through at once." Elodie looks towards the stone wall surrounding the house, the gables rising above it. There is an expression of utter longing on her face, and I vow to make certain that Roger Westbury has a particularly uncomfortable winter. She turns back to him and says, "I suppose it's okay to buy a cup of tea?"
"Of course. The cafe is just behind us, over there in the long barn near the Haverstad Brook. The gift shop is beside it. You might like to pick up a nice bag or a poster for your wall."
Elodie starts towards the barn, and when she is halfway there, without a hint of duplicity, she turns right instead of left and slips past the open wrought iron gate and into the walled garden of the house. She is wandering along the paths now, and I am following her. There is something different in her attitude today. She does not take out Edward's sketchbook, and she does not wear the mooning expression of completeness on her face that she did yesterday. She is frowning slightly, and I have the distinct impression that she is looking for something specific. She is not here just to admire the roses. In fact, she is avoiding the prettiest parts of the garden and tracing the outer border where the walls are covered with rampant ivy and other creepers. She stops and digs around in her handbag, and I wait to see whether she will pull out the sketchbook. She withdraws a photograph instead, a colour photograph of a man and a woman sitting together outdoors in a grove of abundant greenery. Elodie is holding the photograph up, comparing it with the garden walls behind, but evidently she is not pleased with the comparison because she lowers her hand and continues on the path, following it around the corner of the house and past the chestnut tree at the back. She is nearing Jack's rooms now, and I am determined that she should not be allowed to go without my learning more. I see her glance towards the kitchen where yesterday she saw Jack scraping his pie dish. She is in two minds. I recognise the signs. She just needs a little encouragement, and I am only too happy to provide it.
Go on,
I urge her.
What have you got to lose?
He might even let you look inside the house again. Elodie goes to the door of the malt house and knocks. Jack, meanwhile, who has been keeping odd hours of an evening and sleeping poorly, is napping and does not stir. But I refuse to see her leave, so I kneel down close beside him and blow with all of my might into his ear. He sits bolt upright and shivers, just in time to hear the second knock. He staggers over and pulls open the door. Hello again, she says. There is no hiding the fact that he has just got himself out of bed, and she adds, I'm sorry to disturb you. Do you live here? Temporarily. He gives no further explanation, and she is too polite to ask. I'm sorry to bother you again, but you were so kind yesterday, I wondered if you'd mind letting me look inside the house again. It's open now. He nods towards the back door, indicating the other tourists who have just been disgorged. Yes, but your colleague on the ticket desk pointed out that I was too late today to be sold a ticket for the last entry period.
Did he? What a pedant.
She smiles, surprised. Yes, well, I thought so too. But you seem less pedantic. Look, I'd let you in any time, but I can't tonight. My colleague informed me earlier that he's sticking around to supervise some repairs. Worse luck, he expects to be back tomorrow morning to oversee the return of the furniture to its proper place. Oh, if you come back at midday, they should be done. Midday, she nods thoughtfully. I have another appointment at 11, but I could come straight after that. Great. Great. She smiles again. She is nervous of him. Well, thanks. I might just go and enjoy the garden for a little longer now, until they kick me out. Take your time, he says. I wouldn't let them do that. It is almost 6 o'clock. The last of the day's visitors are being ushered to the gate when Jack finds her sitting on a garden seat against the stone wall that separates the lawn from the orchard. He has split a beer into two small glasses and hands one to her.
I told my colleague that my cousin had dropped in to say hello.
Thank you.
You looked like you could use a little longer.
He sits on the grass. Cheers. Cheers. She smiles and takes a sip of beer. Neither one speaks for a while, and I'm deciding which of them to press when she says, This is a beautiful place. I knew it would be. Jack doesn't answer, and after a time she continues. I'm not always so... She lifts her shoulders. It's been a strange day. I had a meeting earlier and I've been reflecting on it. I go back to London tomorrow afternoon and I don't feel like I've done what I hoped to do while I was here. I want Jack to probe further, to ask her what it is that she hoped to do, but he resists my urging, and in this instance he is right, because she fills the silence without being asked. I was given this recently, she says, handing him a photograph.
Nice,
he says.
Someone you know?
My mother, Lauren Adler. Jack shakes his head, uncertain. She was a cellist, pretty famous.
And he's your dad?
No, he was an American violinist. They'd been playing together, a concert in Bath, and were driving back to London when they stopped for lunch. I had hoped that I might find the spot where they were sitting. He hands back the photograph. They had lunch here. I think so. I'm trying to find that out for sure. My grandmother lived in this house for a few years, from when she was 11. She and her family had to evacuate out of London after their house was bombed in the Blitz. Grandma B isn't alive anymore, but her brother, my great-uncle, told me that in the week before this photo was taken, my mother came to see him, eager to know the address of this house.
Why?
I think that's what I'm trying to work out. We have this family story, A fairy story, really. That's been passed down the line. I only found out the other day that it was set in a real house. My great-uncle told me that he had a friend here, a local person who told him the tale when he was a boy. He told my mum and she told me. The story is special to us. The house is special too. Even now, today, sitting here, I feel a strange sort of possessive feeling. I can understand why my mother wanted to come here. But why then? What was it that made her go and see her Uncle Tip and then come here that day? So she is Tip's great-niece, and little Tip is still alive, and he remembered the story that I told him. If I had a heart, it would be warmed. I feel the ripples, too, of other memories shifting when she speaks about her mother, the cellist, and the photograph of the two young people in the ivy. I remember them. I remember everything. Memories like the jewels in the kaleidoscope that Pale Joe kept upon his toy shelf. Discrete gems that shift into new positions when they're put together, creating different but related patterns every time. Elodie is looking at the photograph again. My mother died just after this was taken. I'm sorry. It was a long time ago. I'm still sorry. Grief doesn't have a time limit, I've found. No, and I'm lucky to have it. The photographer who took it is famous now, but she wasn't back then. She was staying around here and came across them by chance. She didn't know who they were when she took the shot. She just liked the way they looked. It's a great photograph. I was sure that if I explored every inch of the garden, I'd turn a corner at some point and see it in front of me, the very spot. And that then maybe I'd somehow know what my mother was thinking that day. Why she was so eager to get the address. Why she was here. The unspoken words with him drift into the cooling air and disappear. Elodie's phone rings then, an unnatural jarring noise. She glances at the screen but does not take the call. I'm sorry, she says with a quick shake of her head. I'm not usually so expansive. Hey, what are cousins for? Elodie smiles and finishes her beer. She hands him the glass and tells him that she'll see him tomorrow. I'm Jack, by the way, he says. Elodie. And then she tucks the photograph back into her bag and leaves. Jack has been reflective ever since she left. The carpenter was here all evening, clattering carelessly with his hammer and nails, and after an hour or two being unable to settle to anything, Jack went through to the house and asked if he could help. It turns out he is handy. The carpenter was happy to have an assistant, and they worked together without saying much of consequence for the next 2 hours. I like that he has added something material to the house that will remain when he is long gone. Jack ate toast with butter for dinner and then telephoned his father in Australia. There was no anniversary this time on which to hang the call, and conversation for the first 5 minutes was stilted. Just as I thought things were winding up, Jack said, Do you remember how good he was at climbing, Dad? Remember that time Tiger got stuck up the mango tree, and he climbed all the way up after him and brought him down? Who is he, and why does Jack look so sad when he speaks about him? Why does his voice constrict and some slight shift in his bearing make him seem like a lonely child? These are the sorts of wonderings that occupy me. He is asleep now. The house is quiet. I am the only presence shifting in these rooms, and so I have come up to Juliet's bedroom, where Fanny's likeness hangs. In her new green dress, the young woman gazes at the painter. The portrait catches her forever as she was in the spring that she met Edward. She stands within an elaborate room decorated in her father's style. The gaping sash window beside her is open, and such is Edward's eye for detail, his skill, that one can feel the freshness of the air against her right forearm. Damask curtains fall on either side of the glass in rich shades of burgundy and cream, framing a timeless rural view. But it is the light, always the light that makes his paintings sing. Critics argued that the depiction of Fanny was more than just a portrait, that it was a comment on the juxtaposition of youth and timelessness, of society and the natural world. Edward was drawn to illusion, and it is possible that he had all of these oppositions in mind when he set up his easel. It is certainly true that the painting served a double purpose. For the view through the window of a summer field yellowed by heat is unremarkable in every way, until one notices in the distance, almost disappeared behind a copse of trees, a railway engine pulling four carriages. This was no accident. The painting of Fanny in the green velvet dress was commissioned by her father on the occasion of her 18th birthday, and the engine was no doubt an attempt to appeal to him. Edward's mother would have urged such flattery. Her ambitions for her son were naked, and Richard Brown was one of the railway kings, a man who had made his fortune in steel production and was happily poised to enlarge his business at the precise moment the railway lines were spreading across the face of Britain. Mr. Brown adored his daughter. I read his interview in the police reports that Leonard obtained when he was working on his thesis. He was distraught after Fanny's death and determined that her legacy should not be tarnished by any talk of a broken engagement and certainly not of another woman in Edward's personal life. Fanny's father was a powerful man. Until Leonard started his digging, Mr. Brown had managed to cut my page completely from history's book. To such lengths would a father go for his beloved child. Parents and children, the simplest relationship in the world, and yet the most complex. One generation passes the next a suitcase filled with jumbled jigsaw pieces from countless puzzles collected over time, and says, "See what you can make out of these." To that end, I have been thinking about Elodie. There is something in her nature that reminds me of Pale Joe. I noticed it when she first arrived yesterday, the way she introduced herself to Jack, the way she answered his questions. She is thoughtful and considered in her responses, listening carefully to what he says, partly, one can tell, because she wants to do justice to what he is telling her or asking, but also, I think, because she is slightly worried at all times that she will not be equal to the task. Pale Joe was like that too. In his case, it was a consequence of having a father like his. I expect that it was common in those families of primogeniture, where sons were named for fathers and expected to grow up to fit into a mould, to step into the old man's shoes and continue the dynasty. Pale Joe was proud of his father. He was an important man in government and political circles, and a dedicated collector too. Many a time when I was visiting the attic room and his family were out, Pale Joe would invite me to explore the grand house overlooking Lincoln's Inn Fields. And what a place of wonders it was. His father had travelled the world and brought back all manner of antiquities. A tiger stood beside an Egyptian sarcophagus, which lay beneath a bronze mask rescued from Pompeii, which sneered beside an assortment of miniature Japanese sculptures. There were ancient Greek friezes and Italian Renaissance paintings too, and a number of Turners and Hogarths, even a collection of medieval manuscripts, including a copy of the Canterbury Tales, thought to predate that in the Earl of Ellesmere's library. Occasionally, when his father was hosting a great man of science or art, Pale Joe and I would sneak downstairs to listen at the door to the lecture being given. The house had been remodelled to accommodate long corridors that Pale Joe called the galleries, supported by columns and arches between which the enormous walls were covered with framed artwork and shelves filled with treasures. Sometimes, over the years, when Pale Joe and I were having too much fun to countenance my leaving to complete my day's work, he would bid me to sneak quietly down into the house and find a small curiosity that I could pocket and present to Mrs. Mack as my picking for the day. One might imagine that I felt some guilt over the thievery of such rare and precious artifacts, but as Pale Joe pointed out, many of them had been stolen already from their original possessors, long before I helped them on their way. I ache to know what happened to Pale Joe. Did he marry the lady to whom he alluded that night in his attic when he spoke of unrequited love? Did he find a way to win her heart and to make her see that she would find no kinder man than he? I would give anything to know. I would also like to learn what he became, into which avenue he funneled his great energy, interest and care. For Pale Joe was proud of his father, but he worried about filling the big man's shoes. Make no mistake, Pale Joe let me steal from his father's collection in part because he wanted me to stay longer with him, and in part because he had a rather modern disdain for the accumulation of possessions and wealth. But there was another reason too. Pale Joe allowed me to pinch small items from his father's shelves for the same reason that he refused to use, when young, his father's name. It pleased him to chip away a little at the statue's feet. Pale Joe, Ada, Juliet, Tip. Mrs. Mack used to have a lot to say about one's birds coming home to roost, and she was not talking of chickens or curses. There was a man who used to turn up regularly to buy pigeons from the bird and cage shop downstairs at Little White Lion Street. He ran a messenger service. His birds were sent afar and then dispatched when necessary with an urgent note, for a pigeon will always fly home. When Mrs. Mack talked about birds returning to roost, she meant that if one sends enough opportunities out into the world, eventually they come back. And so my birds are coming home to roost, and I feel myself being drawn inexorably towards the nexus of my story. It all happens so quickly from here. Chapter 22. Summer 2017. Elodie's room at the Swan was on the first floor at the far end of the hallway. There was a lead light window with a box seat for one that provided a glimpsed view of the Thames, and she was sitting with a pile of books and papers beside her, eating the sandwich she'd bought at lunchtime, but had decided would do just as well for dinner. It did not pass beneath Elodie's attention that it had been 1 week exactly since she'd sat in the window of her own flat in London, wearing her mother's veil and watching the same river heave silently towards the sea. A lot had happened since then. Ergo, she was ensconced in a room of her own in the tiny village of Birchwood, having been to the house itself not once but twice since she'd arrived in town yesterday afternoon. Today had presented something of a frustration. As she was being led around Penelope's friend's elaborate conversion in Southrop, admiring politely the boundless soft furnishings in every shade of tasteful grey, Elodie had been longing to get back to the house. She had extricated herself as soon as possible with a promise to return tomorrow at 11, telephoned a local taxi, and then had to bite her hand to stop herself from crying tears of frustration as they travelled 10 miles per hour behind the ambling piece of farm machinery. She hadn't made it back to Birchwood Manor before closing time, but she had at least been able to gain access to the garden. Thank God for Jack, who clearly didn't work for the museum, but apparently had some function there. She had met him yesterday when she'd arrived off the train from London and walked down to the house. He'd let her in, and as soon as she'd stepped across the threshold, she'd been overcome with certainty that for the first time in a long time, she was exactly where she was supposed to be. Elodie had felt a strange sense of being drawn further inside, as if the house itself had invited her, which was a ridiculous thing to think, let alone say, and no doubt an imagining created in order to justify an entry that was almost certainly not authorised. As Elodie finished the sandwich, her phone rang, and Alistair's name appeared on the screen. She didn't pick up, letting it ring out instead. He would only be calling to tell her again how upset Penelope was, and to ask her to reconsider the wedding music. When Elodie had first told him, there had been silence at the other end of the line, so that she'd thought at first the connection had been lost. And then, "Are you joking?" he said. "Joking? No, I..." "Listen." He'd made a small choked noise of laughter, as if he were sure there'd been a simple misunderstanding that they would soon sort out. "I really don't think you can back out now. It isn't fair." "Fair?
On Mother. She's very invested in playing the videos. She's told all of her friends. It would crush her. And for what?
I just don't feel comfortable with it.
Well, we're certainly not going to find a better performer.
Noise had come from his end of the line, and Elodie had heard him say to someone else,
"Be there in a minute,"
before he returned to the call.
"Look, I've got to go. Let's leave this for now, and we'll talk about it when I'm back in London, okay?"
And before Elodie could tell him that no, actually, it wasn't okay, she had made a decision, and there was nothing further to talk about. He'd gone. Now, alone in the quiet hotel room, Elodie was aware of a constricted feeling that had spread across her chest. Possibly she was simply tired and overwhelmed. She would have liked to talk to someone who'd agree that's all it was and tell her everything was fine. But Pippa was the obvious choice, and Elodie had a strong suspicion that Pippa would not tell her what she wanted to hear. And where would that leave her? In a mess. An enormous mess. And Elodie did not like messes. Her entire life had been an exercise in avoiding, sorting, and eradicating them completely. So she put Alistair out of her mind and took up the articles instead. Tip had turned up out of nowhere with them on Thursday. He'd been standing outside her flat beside his old blue bicycle when she arrived home from work. He'd had a canvas satchel over one shoulder, which he took off and handed to her.
"My mother's pieces," he'd said. "The ones she wrote when we were living at Birchwood."
Inside the satchel was a tattered cardboard folder containing typewritten pages and a large collection of newspaper clippings. The byline belonged to Juliet Wright, Elodie's great-grandmother. "Letters from the Laneway," she'd read.
"My mum wrote them during the war. They came to your grandma B after Juliet died, and then to me. Seemed like it might be the right time to pass them on to you."
Elodie had been overwhelmed by the gesture. She remembered her great-grandmother vaguely. There had been a visit to a very old woman in a nursing home when Elodie was around 5. Her abiding memory was a head of paper-white hair. She asked Tip what Juliet had been like.
"Wonderful. She was smart and funny. Acerbic at times, but never with us. She looked like Lauren Bacall, if Lauren Bacall had been a 1940s journalist in London and not a Hollywood star. She always wore trousers. She loved my dad. She loved Bea, Red and me."
"She never married again?"
"No, but she had a lot of friends, people who'd known him, theatre people. And she was a fierce correspondent, always writing and receiving letters. That's how I think of her now, sitting at her writing desk, scribbling away."
Elodie had invited him upstairs for a cup of tea. She had a list of questions that had formed since she'd been to see him at his studio at the weekend, particularly after Pippa had given her Caroline's photograph. She showed it to him, explained when and where it had been taken, and watched closely, trying to read his expression. "Do you recognise the place that they're sitting?" He shook his head.
"There's not a lot of detail. Could be anywhere."
Elodie had been sure that he was obfuscating. She'd said, "I think she went to Birchwood Manor with him on the way home to London. The house was special to her, and it seems that he was too." Tip had avoided her eyes, handing the photograph back.
"You should ask your dad about it."
"And break his heart in the process. You know he can't say her name without weeping."
"He loved her, and she loved him. They were best friends, the two of them."
"But she betrayed him."
"You don't know that."
"I'm not a child, Tip."
"Then you've seen enough to understand that life is complicated. Things aren't always what they seem."
His words had echoed eerily the comment her father had made on the subject all those years ago when he said that life was long, that being human wasn't easy. They'd changed the subject, but Tip reprised it when he was leaving, saying again that she should speak to her father. He'd said it firmly, almost like an instruction.
"He might surprise you."
Elodie wasn't so sure about that, but she certainly intended to pay Tip another visit when she got back to London.
She had refrained on Thursday from asking him again about the woman in white, feeling that she'd pushed the friendship far enough for one day. But this morning, over breakfast, when she was reading Juliet's articles, something had struck her as odd. She riffled through the folder now to find a particular article. Most of the letters from the Laneway pieces were stories about people in the local community, others about her own family. Some were touching, others very sad. A few were laughably funny. Juliet was the sort of writer who did not ever completely disappear from the page. Each turn of phrase was distinctly her own. At one point, in an article about the family's decision to adopt a homeless dog, she had written, "There are five of us living in our house. Me, my three children, and a flame-haired figment in a white dress. Created by my son's imagination, and so vivid to him that we must consult her on every family decision. Her name is Birdie, and thankfully she shares my son's affection for dogs. Although she has specified that she would prefer an older dog with a settled temperament. It is a sentiment, happily, with which I fully concur. And so both she and Mr. Rufus, our newly arrived arthritic 9-year-old hound, are welcome to remain part of the family for as long as they so choose." Elodie read the lines again now. Juliet was writing about her son's imaginary friend, but the description was uncannily similar to the woman in the photograph, Edward Radcliffe's model. Juliet also wrote that her son had called the figment Birdie. The letter that Elodie had found behind the mount of the framed photograph of Radcliffe's model was addressed to James Stratton and signed from B.B. While Elodie didn't think for a second that Tip's childhood imaginary friend was going to prove a profitable avenue of inquiry, having now read Leonard Gilbert's book twice since Pippa gave it to her, she had started to wonder whether there might not be another explanation. Whether perhaps her great-uncle had seen a picture of the woman when he was a child, maybe even the lost painting itself. Edward's book contained preliminary sketches that suggested he was about to start on a new work featuring his model, Lily Millington. What if the lost painting had been at Birchwood Manor all this time, and Tip had discovered it there as a boy? There was no point ringing him to ask. He didn't like the telephone, and besides, the last number she had for him was so outdated it was a digit short. But she would be going to see him again, at his studio, as soon as possible. Elodie yawned and climbed down from the window seat, taking Leonard's book with her and hopping into bed. In lieu of the house itself, the book was a close second. Leonard's own love for Birchwood Manor was tangible, even as he wrote about Edward Radcliffe's consuming passion for the place. There was a photograph of the house inside the book, taken in 1928 during the summer that Leonard Gilbert had been in residence. The property had been neater back then, the trees smaller, the exposure of the photograph blown out so that the sky looked smaller too. There were earlier photographs as well, images from the summer of 1862 when Edward Radcliffe and his artist friends had been in residence. They didn't look like the usual Victorian portraits. The people in them gazed at Elodie across time and made her feel strange, as if they were watching her. She had felt like that at the house too, had turned around a couple of times expecting to see Jack behind her. She read for a while, dipping into the chapter that outlined Lily Millington's supposed role in the theft of the Radcliffe Blue Diamond. Elodie had found a later article published by Leonard Gilbert in 1938, in which he walked his theory back, based on further interviews with his anonymous source. But it wasn't often cited, probably because it didn't offer much new to scholarship beyond further uncertainty. Elodie didn't know a lot about jewellery. She would be hard-pressed to spot the difference between a priceless diamond and a glass pretender. Her attention went now to her own hand, lying across the page of Leonard's book. After Alistair had slipped the diamond solitaire on her finger, he told her she could never take it off. Elodie had thought he was being romantic, until he said, "A diamond that size, far too expensive to insure." It worried her daily, the value of the engagement ring. Sometimes, despite what Alistair had said, she took it off before work and left it at home. The claws snagged on her cotton archival gloves, and she was terrified that if she removed it at her desk, it might drop into one of the boxes and never be seen again. She'd agonised over where to hide it before deciding on her childhood charm box, where it could nestle in amongst the cheerful little girl treasures. There was an irony to the choice, and it seemed like the perfect dissemblance to hide the diamond in plain sight. Elodie switched off the bedside lamp, and as she watched the minutes on the digital clock change with interminable slowness, her mind went to the reception venue in Southrop. She didn't think she could face another round tomorrow of inane chatter about the happiest day of her life. She had a train to catch at 4 in the afternoon. What if she were held up again, looking through pictures of different place settings and missed